Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to be joining everyone again tonight. We're going to be doing another featured chapter from the Wilderness EMS textbook this evening, and I can't wait to jump into that subject because we've got some friendly returning guests that you all will enjoy, I'm sure. Of course, we have to talk about what's going on with our co-host Sam Bradley, because apparently, as Kyle said earlier when we brought him on the call to begin this show tonight, the wind has been whistling down the plains.
Yes, it has, here in the Front Range, and he said I could see it if I look out there, but all I know is it nearly blew me over this afternoon, so that probably attests to why my audio was having problems earlier. So, I want you guys to know, too, Kyle has a fan. He has a fan in UK. I just thought you might want to know that, his very own fan. I think that's pretty cool. What say you, Kyle?
Hey, Sam, and everyone out there in Disaster Podcast land. It's great to have fans in the UK and all over the world. It's, one of the wonderful perks of working with all of you fine folks on the Disaster Podcast. But speaking of things weather-wise, definitely was a windy day here in Colorado. We had a bunch of power lines and trees down in Pitkin County, Colorado, near Aspen this morning. So that was a, I'll put that in air quotes, interesting morning. But looking back over this past week, wow is all I can say. Just simply wow. Big late season winter storm brought widespread, severe convective and winter weather from the Rockies all the way to the East Coast and on down to the Gulf of Mexico. And all of that stemming from one parent low pressure system, those big red L's you see on the weather maps when you watch the weather. Just some quick highlights from the last week. Everything from historic winter conditions in the Midwest, like Wisconsin, Green Bay Airport broke their all-time snow record from a single winter storm, with almost 3 feet of snow being reported, with drifts burying the first floor doors and windows. We had whiteout conditions across the eastern plains of Colorado, with numerous road closures and motorists being stranded and shelters getting set up. Looking further south down across Missouri, Arkansas, and Louisiana, we had some quick growing thunderstorms producing large hail. They then began to rotate, producing tornadoes, with over 40 tornadoes being reported on April 13 alone. And finally, South Carolina and the Southeast U.S. Typically have the highest likelihood of seeing tornadoes in severe weather this time of year. As we would expect, the tornado threat actually shifted late this past week to the Carolinas and Virginias. And there was several tornadoes reported, including a this one is just blows my mind. An EF1 tornado near Reidsville, North Carolina, 7 individuals injured, including a father and son, critically injured when a double-wide home was picked up and thrown into their moving vehicle. So we are definitely off to an active start, and I'll tell you, things are not slowing down by any means weather-wise. That's a quick look at the past week in weather, Sam. What say you?
I say, good grief. I think the bottom line here, it's a mess. So we're going to go to Dr. Joe and say hi, but we got Dr. Seth Hawkins in North Carolina. Have you been hit with any of that, Seth?
Yeah, we did have a tornado touchdown in a community nearby me in Greensboro, North Carolina, and had snow in the mountains in the middle of April, which is pretty unusual.
Yeah, it sounds like it's all... Well, April weather in Colorado was always kind of hinky, but man, this is scary stuff, especially all those tornadoes. So, Dr. Joe, how are things down there in Memphis?
Things are actually beautiful. It's been a lovely day here today. Nice sunshine and no bad weather at all.
Very nice. What about you, Jamie, out there on the East Coast?
Well, let's see. It was Saturday. It was about 80 degrees and sunny and gorgeous. And Sunday morning, I woke up to 40 degrees and windy. So welcome to Maryland in April.
Wow. That looks like Dr. Ben Abo had a perfect day, too. We're going to get to him in just a minute. Seth, before we do that, this book I have is full of yellow marks and little sticky notes, and I'm just like totally wrapped up in it. And, of course, we're talking about the Wilderness EMS book by Seth C. Hawkins and friends, of which there are many. And we're going to talk about a chapter in that tonight. But one of the things I was really impressed with was your preface, and you talked about a picture, which, of course, the listeners can't see, but it was a picture of a rescue going over water. And the way that that affected you really affected me. Could you speak to that for just a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kind of a cool story. I was sitting in an art gallery in Philadelphia a couple years ago before the book was even accepted by a publisher, and saw this painting by Winslow Homer, The Lifeline, that like you say, depicts a rescuer on essentially what amounts to like a Tyrolean traverse or a rescue line across breaking waves. And knew immediately I wanted that to be the cover to our book. And as I got a publisher and we talked it through, they came to convince me that that wouldn't be the best cover for, you know, marketing and image purposes, but the image still stuck with me really strongly. So I put really strong petitions to them to have it as a foreword in the materials in the front of the book, which they adamantly said was never done in medical textbooks and they wouldn't agree to. And after months and months of negotiations, they finally relented. And it did make for a kind of a cool introduction to the book. And really, you have to, I think, read the preface to really appreciate the sequencing. But at the end of the day, one of the things that I came to realize was so compelling to me about the painting is that the rescuer's face is completely obscured by a scarf that the person being rescued is wearing. And one of the messages I got from that was for many of us, and for those listening to podcasts and for those reading these books, there's a certain anonymity to this dialogue. I think one of the cool things about podcasts is that you're just hearing voices. You don't have a lot of other imagery to get in your mind. It's sort of like reading a book versus watching a movie. Listening to the podcast, you're building images in your own mind about how things look. And in the same way here, with the face obscured, you can kind of put any face on this painting. Reading the book, you can kind of put any face into the pages where it describes these ways to help people in wilderness environments. And so my big pitch was that this is you. Like when you're listening to this podcast or you're reading this book, that anonymity allows you to insert yourself into the storyline and imagine yourself doing these things and performing these actions, which the painting, I think, really exemplified.
Oh, that is so awesome. What do you think of that, Joe?
Oh, I love that painting. I looked at that and read the foreword there as well, and thought the whole idea was amazing.
Well, let's jump into the fun stuff. We got Dr. Ben Abo with us, one of our very favorite people, and Seth, we're going to let you introduce him.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny, you know. Ben's the guy that needs no introduction, so.
Not for us, anyway.
For the 1% of the listening public that's not heard about this international man of mystery who goes by the hashtag Ben Without Borders, Ben Abo has a now storied history in the worlds of disaster medicine and wilderness medicine and EMS. So he was the pilot extern for us at the Carolina Wilderness EMS externship in 2011. And really kicked off our program in there almost a half a decade ago, taking the risk of being our first wilderness EMS extern. And he's completed an EMS fellowship at the University of Florida. He's a board certified emergency physician, as well as the medical director at Hollandale Beach. And he's also a member of the Florida Task Force 1 USAR team based in Miami-Dade. I think they were very operative in the recent and very tragic bridge collapse that he might be able to address. And just to keep things exciting and different, and to make all of us feel like we actually are sitting still. He is the founder and director of an international nonprofit called Urgent that works around the world on EMS and disaster management initiatives. He might also be able to address that, but a real luminary now in our fields.
Busy guy. And if you ever want to call Ben, just pick up a banana. We'll talk about that later. Hi, Ben.
Hi there. You're proud to be here. Thanks.
Well, the last time we talked to you, and we did do a podcast with you some time ago, you talked in general about bites and stings and snakes and so forth. But now we're really looking at this in terms of the wilderness provider, those that wish to be one. So that's kind of the focus here. Am I right?
Yes, indeedy.
Yeah, this is Seth. I should clarify for the purposes of the book. He is the author of two of the chapters, a co-author of the Open Water Rescue chapter, which is really meaningful given his Florida operations. And then also he's the author of the Animal Bites and Stings chapter. And in that capacity, he's serving as a medical director with Venom 2 and Venom 1 in Florida, and he can also probably speak to that experience as well, though we might need a couple hours for all these stories.
Well, let's put up the water rescue till later, because I'm sure that's a podcast in and of itself. But there's such good information in this one. I can't tell you how much I've learned, but Ben, one of the first things you talk about is non-venomous versus venomous. And I think and poisoning versus envenomation.
Oh, yes.
An important difference you taught me. Would you like to clarify that for the listeners?
Yes. So, it's semantics. And when you get into other countries, they don't care as much about the semantics of poison versus venom. But it's always been important to me, and especially learning from such a mentor and great friend as Seth, hashtag words matter, and semantics. So there is a difference between poison and a venom. And a venom is a type of poison. It's a toxin, but it's a specific type. It has to be made in a gland, has to be injected. So you could think about it as if I eat something and I die, that's a poison. If something bites me and I die, that's a venom. So that's an easy way to kind of think of it. But basically, a venom needs to be injected into you. It could be by the fangs, like a snake. It could be there's a little spur off the back of the foot of a duck-billed platypus, and that injects the venom there. There's different ways that venom can be delivered. A bee sting is through, obviously through the stinger. But it has to be injected, as opposed to a poison is a toxin that can go through inhalation, it can go through the skin, it can be injected, it can be ingested. So there's a big important difference in terms of a poison versus a venom. And it varies.
So poisonous animals are not venomous animals necessarily, correct?
Correct. Venomous is poison, but poison is not necessarily venom.
So how would I know as a wilderness practitioner that a bite is venomous or not? Obviously some of it has to do with the critter involved, if you know what that is, but what does the bite itself tell me?
So the difference, the definition of a poison versus a venom has to be injected, kind of going back, maybe I'm double tracking, but just in case, it reiterates in redundancies for a reason. And a poison can be ingested, it can be injected, it can be touched, inhaled, anything. So in terms of trying to recognize, and Sam, you had asked in terms of how do you recognize, how do you realize if you've been bit by something, if it's poisonous or it's venomous? And really, unless it's something that's obviously like a lion or something like that, where there's not a venom, treat it like it's venomous. If you're bit by a snake or a lizard, or you're brushed up against by a duck-billed platypus, treat it as an envenomation, even if you don't have signs, and let the experts figure that out. Because a lot of people die by thinking that it's a dry bite or that it's not venomous, and then all of a sudden, boom, they're paralyzed or they're bleeding out or a combination thereof.
Well, given that, I, as a responder, who am not crazy about snakes, would be seriously concerned about that snake still being around. What are some of the scene safety issues that we need to look at?
That's a very interesting point. And even I was thinking back, I just recently was lecturing about venom, and there was taking it back to the U.S. for a moment, even in the city where the city of Austin, there was somebody that legally had a king cobra, and to commit suicide, he had it in the car with him and he taunted it and it bit him multiple times. So imagine being a first responder. You get called for a 17-year-old boy, unresponsive. You see an unresponsive kid in the car. You knock on the window. They're unresponsive. So what do? You break the window open. You pull them out. You start working them. And then all of a sudden, someone finds a suicide note on the dash that says what happened. And you see the bite marks all over. You know, just saying scene safe BSI with your hands up doesn't make the scene safe.
Oh, my God. I'm just visualizing this cobra's head coming into the window.
And that crazy. Right, talk about, like, craziness. And I have a fun fact and confession to make. Until recently, I was very, very, very phobic to snakes. I would handle the venom in a patient, but don't bring the snake anywhere near me. Just a picture is fine. And that's safe for a couple reasons. I'm sure we're going to loop back to that. But know this. Snakes and venomous creatures are not preying upon you. We're too big. We're too scary. The only time that we get tagged, that we get bit, is if we pop into somewhere where they're expecting food because they're ambush predators. But for the most part, they're scared and they're doing it only out of defense. They have nothing else to do. So usually, as long as you let them go, they're going to go away. So when someone gets bit, by the time you get there, that snake is probably gone. They're not going to say, you know what? I bit the guy anyway. He looks a little tasty. He looks like a sweet guy. I'll stick around and eat him. They don't do that. So so look around, at least in terms of snakes and venomous reptiles. Same with even I recently just had here in Florida. It's an exotic animal, but I had a crocodile monitor bite. And they have teeth like velociraptors. They look like little Komodo dragons, but they're smaller, but they're longer. And they do have a venom in their teeth that makes you bleed, and the wounds bleed a little bit more. But in terms of at least humans, but they're still going to want to get away, right? And the reason why we usually get stung by bees or wasps or hornets is because we've encroached upon their area, and they're doing it out of defense. Really the bees and the hornets and that stuff, that's where you still got to look around and be worried, but otherwise they're going to get away as long as they can get away.
So Jamie, you had a question.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I just remembered yesterday, Maryland Poison Center sent out a notification that they'd received their first copperhead call of the season over the weekend. And we're just, you know, linking us to their site, talking about local venomous snakes. And just reminded me that there are resources out there in your communities that are keeping track of these things. And, that you should make use of them, make yourself aware of who they are and where they are, and be aware of what's local to your community, although you may still run into the odd king cobra by mistake, right?
That's absolutely true. You know, the first snake bite I ever helped treat was in the city of Pittsburgh with Ken Katz. I was a paramedic back in the day, and I think this is probably about a year after Seth graduated from emergency medicine residency this is probably about 2004. And I don't know if you guys are aware, but cobras are not indigenous to the U.S. And classically, what does everybody learn? Where are you going to get this exotic antivenom? You call the zoo. Because the zoos have the snakes. But guess what? It's very hard to get a hold of someone at the zoo, especially even during business hours. And then that zoo has to have the antivenom. They have to be willing to give it to you, and then you have to get it from them. They're not going to just be like, all right, Suzanne is going to come drop it off. It's not that easy. So in Pittsburgh, we had a cobra bite, and the Pittsburgh Zoo does not have any cobras. So what don't they have? They don't have cobra antivenom. So we had to get it flown by, we flew a jet from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia, pick up the antivenom, fly it back, and we gave it to her and saved her. Now, So it gets pretty complicated, and all the poison centers try to have an index of who has what antivenoms, but it's very hard to keep updated. So that's why it's very appropriate. We're talking about this. This is actually the 20th anniversary of Venom 1. Venom 1 being the venom bank in Miami-Dade. If there's an anti-venom, we have it. And not only do we have it in my venom bank, the anti-venoms and plenty of it, we actually also have the logistics already set it up to get it to anywhere in the world. If you pulled up, you go ahead and Google Planet Earth, that's our jurisdiction. We've treated bites in a lot of different places. And if we either get it to them, we bring it to them, or we know places that have it. In the past 2.5 years in the U.S., we've treated 5 cobra bites. There were a couple in third. I just had one like 3 or 4 weeks ago in Tallahassee. We had one in Miami. We had one in Georgia, one in Philadelphia, one in Michigan. All cobra bites. So some we got the antivenom to them, and others we helped them get it around. So you never know what you're going to come across.
That's invaluable, Ben.
And
that is totally invaluable.
Yeah, and the other thing, you're talking about knowing your resources. It's important to know that not all poison centers realize that we even exist. The ones in the Southeast and those that are like true herpetologists or true venomologists or toxinologists, which there's a difference between toxinology with an N and toxicology. I am not a toxicologist. I'm not smart enough to run a poison center and know all that chemistry stuff. But I know animal-made toxins. I know plant-made toxins. And that's what toxinology is. And especially the animal-based and the venom and stuff like that. So, but not all of them know about it. I even was just last week in Houston lecturing, and there were other toxicologists there that didn't realize the resources that we had. And all I did was lecture on what Venom 1 and Venom 2 are. So if you're if you're either in a response area and someone has pets or you're traveling, you should really know these other numbers. And you can say to whatever poison center in your resources, hey, call Venom 1 down to Miami. Call Venom 2. Call Dr. Avo. They'll know how to get in touch with us. They'll call down to Miami Poison and put them in touch with us, or Google our general number. We're available 24/7 for those to help with the exotic stuff.
Such good information. So, Joe, down in your part of the world, you have cotton mouse and water moccasins and all kind of really nasty snakes. How often do you see bites like that maybe in the ER?
Well, they're certainly not uncommon here just because, we're certainly in a part of the world where those kind of pit vipers are pretty common, and people like to drink a lot of beer, and then they like to say, hold my beer and watch this. So they're certainly not uncommon in this area. Our methodology, I think, is a lot like Ben described, where we would we've gone through the zoo. We have a pretty good relationship with our zoo here, and are able to get some of those venoms. And then we have a couple of our larger hospitals that do actually have some antivenom in stock and ready to go.
Yes, I've heard about the correlation with alcohol and men and wanting to pick them up and strange things like that. One thing I want to ask Ben, and Seth can tag on to this, but this is kind of a theme in the book in terms of one of the things I recently did was a training looking at the difference between wilderness EMS and pre-hospital, urban care. And one of those things is we don't worry too much in the field about cleaning a wound because we know the ER is going to do that. But up in when you have a patient for a considerable period of time, it's kind of a different thing. Wound care is really important. It needs to be cleaned even with a non-venomous bite. Ben, can you speak to that? And then I want Seth to throw in on that.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to irritate things too much, and most venoms spread lymphatically. And you want to just basically keep them calm, and the cure to venom is anti-venom. But it is a wound. It's an open wound, so you want to clean it out. It's important, especially if things are delayed. But beyond that, don't mess with things too much, because you don't want to start creeping into some of the proven false treatments, cutting, sucking, extraction, things like that.
You know, on that note, can you go over that? Because so many of us learned all of those wrong things, and I imagine there's still people out there that think that. Maybe it's a good time to tell people what not to do.
Yes. Oh, I'd love to. So, you know, it's funny. In my lectures, I always have, like, the do's and don'ts. The don'ts always overpower. Because of these things that's on the internet, there are things that they sell at some of my favorite stores, some of my non-favorite stores. They sell these kits. There's websites devoted to things, even by supposed doctors, that, oh, why don't you electrocute it? Why don't you use electricity? And they basically sell tasers. You do not want to tase it. You do not hook up your car battery to denature the protein. You do not put ice on it. You do not cut it. You do not suck it. You do not put a venom extractor on it to try and pull and suck the venom out. That stuff not only doesn't work, but it's proven to do more damage. And that's also scientifically proven. One of the great studies, I love it, you know, Sean Bush, you know, he's one of the venom docs, and I'm more the EMS venom doc or venom doc 305. He had a great paper that was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine, and it says venom extractors, they just plain suck. And it's true. They don't do anything. So, again, do not cut, do not suck, do not tase, do not extract, do not prophylactically do fasciotomies. In fact, do not call a surgeon for the most part.
No.
So, really important messages there, and also I think important messaging about direct-to-consumer advertising and the ability in a capitalist healthcare system to, you know, create products around these sort of misconceptions. So I think Ben has probably seen, I've certainly seen a product out there that basically attaches like a battery to a shocking device, and I think Justin was actually the first person I saw who sort of posted it on Twitter and pointed out this patent for this tool. I'm not sure it's actually made it to market, but the capacity of people to see opportunities to make money off products, regardless of whether there's actually medical benefit, is enormous, like we all know. So yeah, no ad hoc shocking from your car battery, and also no buying products that will allow you to shock your buddy who's been bitten by a snake. One thing that we ventured into with the Vertical Aid textbook, which is another medical textbook I've been involved with, and Ben knows where the story's going, was within the pages of this medical book, we argue that the best treatment for snake bites is car keys, and that's actually the teaching that we have in our climbing medicine classes as well. The message of which, or diesel fuel is the other analog to this, the message of which is like, it's important simply to get the patient to antivenin or get that to the patient. And we live in fear that in this social media lack of common sense world, we're going to start seeing cases of people dousing snake bites and diesel fuel, or worse yet, like digging their car keys into them. Like, it's not working. I don't know. It still looks, in fact, it's bleeding now. I don't know.
It's funny. It's sad. And it's going to happen.
but the reality is that's what, so the ideas about shocking your pal who had a snake bite actually came from a Lancet. I can't remember if it was a letter to the editor or an actual legitimate article, but it was
a letter to the editor.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And so one unfortunate publication can drive decades of misunderstanding and ill-informed products. So we're really, really hoping nobody comes up with like snake bite keys, you know, that you can dig into the wound. But really, I think the most important message is getting to somebody like Ben, who has the appropriate medical, you know, medication to address the bite.
So we don't feed the bite victims Tide Pods. Right.
What? No, that is population control. Yeah, that talk about cleaning the wound.
Somebody mentioned Darwin here on the side. That kind of works. Ben, you said something in your chapter about even dead snakes can envenomate. How does that work?
Yeah, so it gets pretty interesting. There are videos that you can see on there. You can tune in my webinar that's coming up for Florida envenomations and stuff in textbook. But basically, even if you behead a snake, as an example, the reflexes can last several hours. In fact, there's a video that I've seen online where a beheaded snake will still be moving around and writhing, trying to bring what was its head, that the head space, so to speak, up to 30 plus hours. It was ridiculous. But even if it's been more than that, even if there's just some venom residue in the tooth and you brush up against it and the tooth gets you, it can inoculate you. There's a very interesting story in terms of, there are plenty of people, and this is why I also say, in terms of the care, do not bring me the snake. Do not try to catch it. Do not try to kill it. We all have smartphones. Just take a picture or try to describe it when you bring it to me. And for the most part, for American snakes in North America, if they're domestic, I can look at the wound and figure out what it is for 98% of it. Now, these reflexes, you literally, you know, if you happen to kill the snake and it's venomous, you need to bury that head really deep, because just brushing up against it, and pit vipers of North America and the others, their teeth retract, but it can still venom you. And a really interesting story, I was giving a venom lecture for EMS for one of the counties in Florida, and I didn't realize there was this box sitting there with an ID on it. And I didn't think of anything of it. I'm lecturing, I'm kind of moving the box around because I talk with my hands. And as it turned out, there was a very beloved fire marshal in this county. And the neighbor had a huge rattlesnake on her patio. So he shot it, blew off half its head, right? So, you know, I don't know if you're an optimist or pessimist, you know, half head, head half there, head half gone, however you look at it. But he picked up the snake and it tagged him. Half its head was gone. It was totally dead. And this has happened also with, like, just the head, when it's brought to the hospital and things like that. But what happened was, this is when they had the old Crofab product that they, from Wyeth. It wasn't really Crofab. They were afraid to use more anti-venom. They were afraid to use too much for very serious envenomation. And the guy died. This is the first time ever in my lecture, because he was so beloved, I've never had a cremated student in my class. That box had an urn with the fire marshal in it. And they thought that would enjoy my lecture, so they brought him in the urn.
Oh my God.
True story. Can't make that up, but it's a great solid reminder of denial is not just a river in Egypt. And there are those reflexes. There's also a story about a cobra that supposedly was stuffed, but there was some venom in the tooth, and someone brushed them against it, cut their arm, and they became symptomatic. I don't know. I wasn't there for that one. But this stuff, but I do know that even a dead snake and even just the head can, in fact, envenom you. And this is why you do not need to catch it. You do not need to kill it. I do not want you to bring the snake to the hospital to identify it. You don't need to do that. I actually got a phone call when I was in a different country lecturing. I was in London. So it was the middle of the night for me, and I get a phone call from the chief medical officer from the hospital because someone brought a snake in for a snake bite, and the ICU fellow wanted to see it. And so the nurse, who was a visiting nurse from the ICU because we were very, you know, understaffed that day, put the snake in a biohazard bag and put it up through the tube system.
No.
I'm sorry. I am laughing hysterically, and I thought I'd better turn my mic on and just acknowledge that
I can't make it up. So I had to like do this whole training, and I'm like, stop sending snakes in tubes. You know, snakes not on planes, snakes not in tubes. And same thing, I have a video where someone brought a copperhead. They're like, oh, doc, it's dead. Oh, doc, it's dead. I said, no, get it out of here. And in our usual, like, the same little biohazard bags that blood samples, like tubes, go into, there is a snake moving around trying to get out of the bag because it was still alive.
Oh, God.
And I have had a nurse at another hospital that I went to handling the head. They were trying to dispose of the snake, and she got envenomed. And that hospital did not have enough anti-venom. So luckily, Venom 1 was already on their way there. And what we do is we deliver not only anti-venom and start treating them, but we bring up extra backup. And the venom stays at the hospital. And we're like, okay, when this patient is discharged, we'll pick up whatever's not used. And so luckily we had enough anti-venom also to treat the nurse.
Oh, my God. You'd think common sense would come in here somewhere.
Common sense is not that common. But at the same time, there's like, I mean, we're talking about snake bites go way, 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 way back. If you look at the Egyptian stories and Greek gods and some of the names that I can't even pronounce, people that were in the Trojan War and everything, it's happened for a number of years. And still, there's a lot of these myths and misconceptions that have been proven wrong that people just don't understand and don't get. And that includes with scientifically proven anti-venoms.
Wow. Everybody needs to listen to this podcast. Seriously.
You know, Ben,
well, on that note, go ahead, Seth.
I am so sorry to be bursting in. Just I was a quiver here with the ancient teachings and the myths. One teaching, which I think is about as ancient as the Egyptians, is the red on yellow, kill a fellow, red on black, venom lack mnemonic for coral snakes. You know, we were talking about cobras earlier and which is an elapid, and the only one elapids we have here in the United States, certainly around the East Coast, would be the coral snake. And one thing I learned from the chapter I hadn't known before working out with you was the failure of that mnemonic, which I would have thought was rock solid from the time of the Egyptians. Do you want to mention why that would not be necessarily safe to live or die by?
Yeah, so that the poem or the rhyme that Seth is referring to is red on yellow, kill a fellow, red on black, friend of Jack. And that's talking about the coral snake and, you know, because it's a red, black, and yellow banded snake. And that only works for North American coral, number one. Number two, it doesn't even work on all North American coral. So that really kind of fails you. If you go to South America or Central America, there's over 40 different patterns that a coral snake can have.
Yeah, one of the coolest pictures in the book that I was most excited to run was figure 19.1 in Ben's chapter, which is chapter 19 on animal bites. So this figure 19.1 shows an eastern coral snake from the United States. And essentially, I think what Ben's getting at is the red on yellow, kill a fellow, red on black, venom black mnemonic fails if you have an example of a snake where the red portion actually has a black banner across the top. So if you're looking directly down at the snake, it can actually look like you don't have a venomous species, which is usually, I think, Ben, right, a king snake, if it's going to be.
Right. It's very hard. Some are actually, you know, whether they're albino or anything else, it's really hard to tell. And then the other ones will say, well, if their head is black, if the tip of their head's black, it's a coral. That actually really does work in North America. But when you look at a coral snake, and they're very timid, actually, unless they're startled or you pick them up, good luck finding where the head is. You can't tell. It's not as obvious as a pit viper or something like that where it rattles up and coils up in a certain way. It's very hard with a coral snake to find that. And I prefer my own poem that I wrote. I don't know if you – did you guys know that I was a poet also?
So, well, it doesn't surprise me.
So the poem that I wrote in terms of snake envenomation is roses are red, violets are blue, don't touch the snake. That's it.
Jimmy, you got to put that somewhere. It's awesome.
I'll include it in the show notes.
Ben the poet, yes. Wow. If you're following along, Kyle, it's page 338, that scary-looking graphic of that eastern coral snake. But, you know, not to get into a long conversation about different kinds of venomous snakes and so forth, but then what are some of the really serious symptomology we would see with an envenomation?
So that's a great question, and the answer is it depends. If you're talking about, are we talking about North America?
Yeah, I think that would make sense because that's where we all live, yeah.
So I'm really glad you asked that. So North American, you know, we learn in the textbooks and even my physician books, we're kind of taught, oh, either the venom makes you bleed to death or you're paralyzed. And even that can get confusing. And the reality is that venom is a cocktail of toxins. And every snake has similarities among the species. But at the same time, you could take the same snake, look at their venom, and this week it's a Tom Collins, and in a month, it's an Old Fashioned, where the toxins within it change. And they don't just simply make you bleed to death, like a pit viper we're taught to. It might make you clot up to use all your clotting factors, and therefore you go into DIC and you bleed. Or it might make you bleed, or it might eat up your platelets, or it might, you know, do a whole slew of other things. There's also cardiotoxins. Even the pit vipers that make you bleed to death overall and destroy your platelets will also cause some neurotoxicity. In fact, the canebrake or the timberlin that's along the coast in Florida, the panhandle and stuff, when they're juvenile, they will actually have neurotoxicity. And then once they're a year old, they'll switch over to a heme toxicity. But overall, if it's a pit viper, a crotalid, not a juvenile canebrake, you have severe pain, you have some bleeding at the wound, and you have pain, swelling, and tenderness elsewhere. And this is another point where I love quoting Seth, hashtag words matter. There's a difference between pain and tenderness. And if you look at the proven suggested algorithm that's by a bunch of experts, they say on there, step, mark the leading edge of pain and swelling and tenderness. But everyone just marks off where the swelling is. Where, let's say I'm bit on the finger because I'm a male and I'm picking up something I shouldn't. I will have severe pain there, maybe some bleeding and oozing wounds in my finger, and my hand is swollen up to my wrist. But I might say to you, hey, I've got pain in my armpit. That's because the venom travels lymphatically. It's already a severe bite. It's traveling up there. Or I might say to you, the swelling's up to my hand. The pain, when you say, where does it hurt? The pain goes up to my elbow. But if you take your finger and you just rub it down, starting at the shoulder, just drag it down the arm, you might only get halfway down my humerus, and I start screaming in pain. That's tenderness. And there's a difference between pain and tenderness. And I personally find that pain and tenderness is a much better marker of venom progression. Because if you elevate your arm, is the swelling going down, or is it just redistributing to your shoulder somewhere else? But overall, you have pain, you swell, you might have oozing. You might have fasciculations, just like when you give succinylcholine, further proximal. And these are usually what you're going to get from the North American pit vipers. The Mojave does have some more neurotoxicity, and you might seize and things like that. But for the most part, you're going to get the heme, the pain, the swelling, and maybe these blebs or ecchymosis, especially water moccasins, cottonmouths. It really is like a totally ecchymotic wound. When you get to the coral envenomation, you're in a human, unless it's a severe bite where you're seeing systemic effects right away, like they syncopize, they're repetitively vomiting, things like that, you're not going to see any symptoms until at least 9 to 10 hours after.
Oh, wow.
And then it goes downhill very fast. And we give coral antivenom not just to treat it and reverse the effects that it has. We're trying to prevent further progression. Because a neurotoxin can attack before or after the synapse. And that's the difference if it's temporary or it's permanent. And I get a lot of people and doctors tell me that say, oh, well, we'll just intubate them and we'll keep them intubated for a week and then we'll wake them up and see what's permanent. Because it'll have bypass by then. And but by then, I had a 7-year-old kid that couldn't run for 7 months. Because whenever he would look down, try and run full speed, he would get this conjugate gaze and he would have double vision and he would fall.
Oh,
some
wow.
of those things are permanent. If you, Sam, were bit by that snake and you had that such a delay, you would not regenerate nerves like the 7-year-old kid would. So you'd be stuck with True. Double vision permanently.
So Seth, yeah, you so had a.
It gets pretty interesting.
Oh, very interesting. Seth, you had a
want
to tag
onto that. I was thinking in the context of disaster medicine and field providers, one of the most common questions that I hear, and I thought Ben might weigh in on, and I'm not sure if he and I have discussed this recently, so we might even have different perspectives, but it's the transport of patients who've been bitten. And one of the most common questions I hear is, I love the idea of, say you're a guy and you touch something you shouldn't. That just goes all sorts of places that I don't know. We need to. I don't know exactly where you're going with that, Ben, but I'm really glad where it ended.
I do.
if you're bitten by a snake, you know, very commonly it's on the hand because you're reaching, you know, inappropriately towards it and threatening it. So if you have an extremity bite like that and you are, say, 3 or 4 hours out from a trailhead, or say you're in a disaster area where a lot of snake activity has been instigated. One of the really cool wilderness environmental medicine publications that came out was an analysis of snake activities during disasters and how much more active they are because of the parameters of the disaster environment. So even if you're in a disaster setting and you're bitten and you're many hours away from what would be considered your extrication or your definitive care. So the questions I get are, do you hold that extremity vertical, horizontal, or inferior, like to the heart? And do you allow that person to walk out, or do they have to be carried out? And I think those are two of the most common practical real-world EMS questions I hear.
That's you know, we have not talked about that. We touched upon it a little bit when we were training some of the fellows and all back in September, but really, they're still trying to figure out more of it out. And first, there's the thought of you don't want the venom getting to the body, so you don't want to raise the arm. You need to keep it down below the heart. But in reality, venom travels lymphatically unless they're injected right into a blood vessel. So that doesn't work, and it becomes very swollen and more dependent. Really, the solution to pollution is dilution. So then the thought was, well, maybe we'll elevate it and let it get into the bloodstream. How severe a bite is like, when is the venom going to go from the lymphatics into the bloodstream and then become systemic? And you get some of those other signs. Well, we generally, for the most part, recommend, and this is the venomologist also down in Australia, and around the U.S. and Europe and all, what we do is we suggest at the level of the heart. Now, that's easy if it's the hand, right? But number one thing you want to do is you want to keep them calm and get them out as soon as possible. We really need to weigh in the situation of what's going on. And if they're in the foot, you know, you don't want to use it, things like that. But you got to weigh in the scenario of what's going to get them out more quickly, because time really is tissue.
Yeah. So I could say that's the same teaching that I do. It was actually Tony Pizon out of Pittsburgh who really started.
Tony.
Yeah. He was in the same era of residency as I was, and he really jazzed me up to the same idea you're describing, that in a normal adult who's not immunocompromised and is otherwise healthy, there's enough biomass to kind of distribute the venom out. It's lymphatically distributed, so it doesn't move that quickly anyway. And that in fact the fears that we had about having the venom distribute through the body and go to the heart and kill you were pretty mythical, unless you're like a very young kid or you're elderly or immunocompromised or some other way compromised in your health. By the same token, you know, you don't necessarily want to accelerate. So in Burke County and other systems I work with, we teach about transport at the level of the heart. But the other thing you're saying that I just think is so important and really does have a huge bearing on operations is not promoting this idea that somebody needs to wait to be carried out if they can actually, you know, walk on their own. I think that that, you know, the book, so the book doesn't actually address extremity positioning. So I'm always learning these things that we need to get into the second edition, which Ben, that'll definitely be one of them. But the book is really clear that nothing should be done which can slow or impair the ability of a patient to get quickly to the appropriate antivenin. And I think definitely waiting for, you know, 4 hours for a team to arrive to carry somebody out, which we know is 20 times, that's not mathematical, but speculative, 20 times longer, you know, to get the person out of the environment is probably a mistake if they can slowly and calmly ambulate on their own. At least that's my impression, Ben. I don't know.
Yeah, and that in early renditions of the chapter and even some of the handouts and the pamphlets that I have and the information I try and put online, you know, the early iterations had a suggestion of limit movement, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't want people to think that you had to carry everybody out because the situation is very dependent. It's very easy in the Everglades. We can send a helicopter from Miami-Dade and scoop you up, as opposed to Limbo Gorge, where you got to be carried out and it could take longer. So it's really dependent. I didn't want people to be afraid of letting somebody walk, because in reality, depending on the scenario, they might be able to get to care more quickly. And really, time can make a really big difference.
Well, I want to go to the peanut gallery.
Really just don't want to delay things. What's that?
I said I want to go to the peanut gallery that have been sitting quietly in the background. Ben, did you have one more myth that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, one and a half. One, the other thing that I forgot to mention, that I think I forgot to mention that I don't want you to do, along with extraction, sucking, cutting, anything like that, shocking, do not put a tourniquet on. Do not.
Thank you.
You'll do more tissue damage. Do not. No tourniquets, anything like that. So that's another thing. But one, people are afraid, they think that, and these are practitioners, and they delay where you're going to go to, things like that, because they think that all antivenoms are made with horse. If you're allergic to horse, you've been bit before, we can't use it again. They're afraid of anaphylaxis. Guess what? We can treat anaphylaxis, right? And Crofab, yep, which is a great product, and they do not endorse me or anything, but it's actually made with sheep in Australia. And they're made in Australia. They make it there and sheep there because there's no mad cow disease. But you don't need to ask someone per se if they're allergic to horses or pecans or anything like that, because it's a great clean product. And the fact of the matter is, we treat anaphylaxis all the time. The only cure to venom is antivenom. So we can't be afraid of using it.
So it's really important.
And along with that, you know, time is super important. And to give it another, you know, metaphor, so to speak, you picture a snowball rolling down a hill. At the beginning of it, you know, at bite time zero, it's very easy to stop that snowball. But if you wait too long, that snowball is getting bigger and faster, and it's harder to stop that venom progressing. And you're actually going to need even more anti-venom. So if you can get them to care, definitive care quickly, and get enough anti-venom on board to treat it aggressively, you end up needing, I might start off with 10 vials instead of 6, but I'm stopping at 10 vials, and I don't need to do 20, 40, 60, 70 vials with some of these bites.
You know, just to close out the myth section, one thing that is a great kind of test question or an exception to our normal rules about wound treatment is ice. So ice is steadily getting like, ice is having a hard time. It's tough to be ice these days. So Dr. Merkin in the 70s proposed RICE, which is rest, ice, compress, elevate, for general kind of soft tissue and bony injuries. Most people are familiar with that concept, and if not, pretty much everybody's familiar with the idea of putting ice onto wounds. In the past, it was a great question to say, what's the one kind of wound that should not get iced? And now it's a little bit trickier because rice and that whole thing is becoming a little bit under attack. But it's never been a snake bite. That's a bad idea. So it's one of the few soft tissue wounds that would not be appropriate to ice.
Correct. And the mechanism behind that is similar to tourniquets. You get vasoconstriction where you have already venom there, and you're going to get more tissue damage there.
Good stuff, guys. Kyle, you've been quietly in the background. Any thoughts or questions?
Well, an initial thought as we were going through the myths, actually many of those used to be taught as the correct method back when I was in Boy Scouts. So it's neat to see that, you know, the research is still progressing and that all these new methods are coming out. And it really does behoove all of us as folks that are listening to this, from citizens all the way up through first responders, providers, and even at the clinician level, to help dispel some of these rumors and carry this education forward. You know, it shouldn't stop at you listening to this podcast. You should really internalize this and carry this forward, especially in continuing education and your everyday practices as well.
Yes, we are here to educate. Dr. Joe, what do you think?
Oh, I'll just agree completely with Kyle. You know, I think there's an awful lot of bad information out there about snakes. There's a lot of mythology around them and the treatment of them. And that's especially complicated in a disaster or wilderness environment. So kudos and thanks to you guys for coming on and addressing those issues and trying to clear some of those myths up. Greatly appreciate it.
God, I love this book. I really do. I've learned so much so far, and I haven't even gone through the whole thing. What do you think, Jamie? Are you well educated now?
Oh, you know, definitely. And it harkens back. If people want even a bigger leap into this topic, they can go back and look back in 2017. We did an episode with Ben on the same thing, similar topics, and talking a little bit more in depth about Venom 1. So they can certainly look back, and I'll have a link to that episode in the show notes as well. But you know, this just tells me the importance of good, high quality training. You know, that you know, we've got to make sure we're getting the best possible information from people who are experts, who understand what they're talking about, who have the experience to back it up. And be able to share that information from a position of knowledge, of experiential knowledge, as much as anything else. And I think that's important.
Absolutely. And that's what Dr. Joe does, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, Joe, I was just thinking, as we're hearing about this and the mention earlier about disaster situations stirring up not just the snake population, but a lot of wild animals are displaced by disasters. And so you have, I think, probably more bites in general during those times and situations. Is that something you guys talk about when you maybe are teaching or training with USAR people and stuff like that?
Yeah, we do indeed. You know, it not only are the animals displaced from their habitat, but we are frequently in their habitat searching for those folks that have gone missing. So it leads to a high population of both groups in the same area. So it's certainly something that we cover routinely. And, you know, it's another one of those examples of how rapidly the science is advancing and the myths are falling by the wayside.
So if somebody wants to bring you guys in to talk about a specific kind of training or something for their area, of course, you can always customize it to their situation and what animals or snakes or whatever might be in their region as well, as the types of specific disasters they're preparing for. How can you help them kind of customize the special type of situational training that they would need?
Well, we're more than happy to talk with folks at any time about how to customize the experience so that it is, you know, as specific and unique to their concerns and needs as we can make it. And pretty much it's limited only by their imagination.
Where can folks reach you guys at Paragon to find out more about that?
So we're on the web at Paragon Medical Education Group. .com, as well as a Facebook page by the same name, Paragon Medical Group. And you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And Ben, where can folks find you? Or is there a place that they can look up and find out more about Venom 1, perhaps?
Yeah, you could go ahead and hit the visit Dr. Google or Google.com. We do have a basic website. Venom 2 is about to launch a new website. I didn't want anything incomplete going up, so there's going to be a pretty inclusive thing, but you can reach us, and you can always Google either or, and of course reach me directly. And soon enough, BenWithoutBorders.com will be up too, where I'll be putting out otherwise the same free lectures as well, and contact information is what's going to be up on Venom 1 and Venom 2. And if you can't remember anything, it's the usual poison control number, 1-800-222-1222.
Excellent. Perfect. Seth, how about you? Where can folks reach out to you and find out more about what you're doing, as well as the Wilderness EMS textbook?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Two resources I think your listeners might really benefit from. One is that the Wilderness Medical Society put out practice guidelines for pit viper envenomations in October of 2015 in their journal Wilderness and Environmental Medicine, and that's available online, open access. In addition, there's a specific, really great, I was mentioning it earlier, article in Wilderness Environmental Medicine. It's a reference to snake identification and first aid for disaster response personnel. It's specifically keyed to hurricane-prone regions in North America, so it's really great resource for disaster responders, and that was in the December 2006 issue of Wilderness and Environmental Medicine. For the textbook that we've been discussing, which cites both of those references, it's Wilderness EMS, and the best URL for it is a bit.ly, so it's bit.ly/WEMS text. And I'm always on Twitter at Hawk Vox, V-O-X, and also on Facebook.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming on and connecting us with all the authors of these amazing chapters in the book. People should definitely check out that bit.ly link. We'll have a link in the show notes and they can check it out. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media platforms under the handle WXKyleNelson. So feel free to connect with me, add me as a connection on LinkedIn, and continue the conversation about weather, disaster medicine, and first response.
And we want to add more people to that WXKyleNelson fan club that's rapidly growing worldwide. So we want to definitely add to that.
I might get two by next week.
No. Sam, where can folks
Jamie.
Find you?
You're going to find me as far away from snakes as possible. Unfortunately, social media doesn't bite, so you will find me under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on our Facebook page for Disaster Podcast, or certainly on disasterpodcast.com. And where is the PodMedic?
Well, that's it. The PodMedic. Find me under that handle on most social media platforms out there. Friend, follow, or otherwise connect with me out there, and we'd love to hear from you. And, of course, you can always find me over on our Facebook page. Just search for our Facebook group and by searching Disaster Podcast. Ask to join the group. We'd love to have you come in and join us. And, of course, you can always find me over at disasterpodcast.com. But, Sam, you know, we talk a lot about different types of disaster medicine. You know, snakes aren't something we're going to run into all the time, but it's certainly something, whether it's a venom, whether it's a poison, some kind of creature that's going to cause us some additional harm than just a normal bite. We need to be prepared to deal with that.
Absolutely. And one of the things I love about this book is it's absolutely updated. Just the discussion of all of these myths around snake bite. I mean, that's just one example. Everything is very up to date, and it just shows how much bad information we've grown up on since Boy Scouts in my initial EMS training. But again, just a perfect example of disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.